Our critic at large, John Powers, has been thinking about two currently popular heroines, Bella from the Twilight series and Lisbeth from Stieg Larsson's Millennium trilogy. John says these heroines have more in common than you might think.
If you look at the most successful pop franchises over the last 50 years, from James Bond to Star Wars to Harry Potter, one thing is obvious. They're dominated by men. Which makes it all the more remarkable that right now there are two cultural juggernauts centering on women. The Twilight series, created by Stephanie Meyer, and Stieg Larsson's Millennium trilogy, featuring the girl with the dragon tattoo. Together, the novels have sold tens of millions of copies, while the screen adaptations are raking in dollars by the hundreds of millions. To be honest, neither Meyer nor Larsson are great writers, but their legions of fans don't care. That's because Twilight and Millennium offer something they like better than literary merit: primal fantasies. And what's interesting is that these two fantasies are almost diametrically opposed, not least in their image of women. As a young adult series embraced by millions of grown-ups, Twilight offers a fantasy of perfect love that's pure adolescent romanticism. Its heroine, Bella, is a high school girl who falls for a handsome vampire, Edward Cullen, and wants to sleep with him. But the old-school Edward won't do it, or turn her into a vampire, unless Bella marries him first. At the same time, Bella's pursued by Jacob Black, a hunk who just happens to be a werewolf. Sadly, he doesn't have a prayer. You see, Jacob's from a Native American family without much money, while the Cullens live in a fancy house and have an aristocratic air. While all this may sound rather wild, the whole thing is in fact strikingly square. Things stay at a level of innocence startling for a present-day vampire story. Here, for example, Bella and her father have to stop Edward from fighting with Jacob.
Edward?
If you ever touch her against her will again...
Don't do this!
She's not sure what she wants.
Don't do this!
Let me give you a clue.
Wait for her to say the words.
Fine.
And she will.
Jacob, just go, okay?
Hey. Easy, guys. Easy. Let's take it down a notch. All right? What's going on?
Kissed Bella.
True blood, this isn't. Turning on kisses, not nudity, the series offers a vision of love that could hardly be more conservative. From beginning to end, the supposed outsider Bella is defined by her romantic yearnings. Love for a man so strong that she'll turn into a vampire to be with him. By series end, such a love has entailed staying a virgin, then getting married out of high school, and then instantly having babies. A friend whose 10-year-old daughter adores Twilight says he's horrified that she might think Bella is somehow a role model. On the face of it, he'd be happier with the values of the Millennium trilogy. It offers not a conservative fantasy of romance, but a liberal fantasy of perfect justice. Where Twilight creates a reality in which the social world barely appears, stories like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo take place in a contemporary world overrun with rapists, serial killers, and corporate bigwigs who are essentially gangsters. Basically, two people stand up against all this. One is middle-aged Michael Blomqvist, a rumpled, womanizing left-wing journalist who's pretty clearly Larsson's romanticized projection of himself. But the series' real selling point is its title heroine, Lisbeth Salander, an extraordinarily vivid pop creation. Abused as a child, Salander has grown up to be tattooed, pierced, bisexual, and aggressively antisocial. Both a ferocious fighter and a genius computer hacker, Salander is defined by no man. Instead, she pointedly takes down men who are violent against women. But to be an unstoppable vessel of justice, she has to cut herself off from all normal emotion and from everyone else, even those who care about her. So far, so good. Yet Millennium's sense of social justice reveals a dark side to liberal righteousness. These are vigilante tales, structured to fill us with such rage that we can't wait for Salander to exact her vengeance. When I recently saw the current episode, The Girl Who Played with Fire, the guy in front of me applauded when Salander took an axe to a baddie. And this was at a screening for a public radio station. All this makes Millennium so different from Twilight that it may seem incredible they're both popular at the same time. Yet the strength of both series lies in something their heroines do have in common: an absolute willingness to go the distance. Say what you will against them, Bella and Solander are not the silly shop-till-they-drop mediocrities celebrated in chick-lit comedies. They are mythically passionate souls who will do what it takes, even give up their humanity, in order to achieve perfection. 007 and Luke Skywalker couldn't do any better than that.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can read David Edelstein's reviews of the films John mentioned on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Watching television between June and August, according to our TV critic David Bean Cooley, used to be a real chore and a real bore. These days, he says, it's anything but, if you know where and when to look.
For the most part, the story of broadcast television has gone like this. Just as bears hibernate in the winter, over-the-air TV networks hibernate in the summer, from the end of May, when the official TV season is over, until mid-September, when it begins again. Oh, every 10 years or so, the broadcast networks will wake up and try something new and interesting. Survivor and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire a decade ago, Northern Exposure a decade before that. But most of the time, what CBS and the other broadcast networks give us isn't much. This summer isn't any different. Oh, we have a fabulous summer run of Friday Night Lights on NBC. But to those of us who saw these episodes already when they premiered on satellite television's DirecTV, they're just another type of summer rerun. And some broadcast shows, like Glee on Fox, are worth watching more than once, so that's something, I guess. But where's the new stuff? Broadcast TV offers us plenty of first-run shows this summer, more than in the past few years, but they're mostly reality show or competition show junk, like Downfall and Big Brother, or subpar dramas like The Gates and The Bridge. The bright spots are few, if you don't have cable or satellite TV, but they are there. Fox has given us Bradley Whitford and Colin Hanks in the enjoyable cop comedy The Good Guys on Mondays. ABC has given us a thoughtful, engrossing documentary series in Boston Med on Thursdays. And that's about it. Ah, but on cable TV, summer is the season when quality TV really ripens. I hate to toss out a long list, but it's the quantity as well as the quality of summertime cable shows that counts. Instead of taking the summer off, my TiVo is working harder than ever, trying to keep up with shows I watch and enjoy each and every week. On HBO, just as Tremé ended, True Blood came back on Sundays, gorier, sexier, and funnier than ever. Showtime ended its seasons of Nurse Jackie and Secret Diary of a Call Girl, but hasn't taken the rest of the summer off. Its talk show featuring comedians talking comedy, The Green Room with Paul Provenza, was a delightful surprise. And in August, Weeds returns, paired with a new show starring Laura Linney, The Big C. On Tuesdays, FX followed its new cop show, Justified, with the newest season of Rescue Me, which is terrific. And with an ambitious new comedy from Louis C.K. called Louis, which I really like. The Sci-Fi Channel has a bunch of fun shows that either returned or premiered this month. Warehouse 13 on Tuesdays, Eureka and Haven on Fridays. And BBC America has been active, too. For genre fans, it has the newest episodes of Doctor Who on Saturdays, followed by a new season of Being Human, which is an alternately goofy and dark series about a werewolf, a vampire, and a ghost, all trying to just get along. BBC America also has what may be the sleeper hit of the summer, In the Choir, which airs Wednesdays. It's a documentary series about a young man in England building choirs from scratch and preparing them for international competition. And I absolutely adore it. That's a long list, but hardly a complete one. I haven't mentioned USA Network's Burn Notice, which is back on Thursdays, or the same network's new Covert Affairs, which just started on Tuesdays. Or TNT's Leverage, which airs Sundays, or Futurama, which Comedy Central just resurrected on Thursdays. And intentionally, I've saved the best for last, because a show is returning that could save the summer all by itself. On Sunday, July 25th, AMC's Mad Men returns for its fourth season. Last season ended with Don Draper, played by John Hamm, quitting his job, gathering some colleagues, and planning to start a new renegade ad agency. That's where this new season begins. And all I'll say about this opening hour of Matthew Weiner's fascinating drama series is that the dominant themes from the very first moments are about identity and reinvention. In fact, here are the very first moments. as Don is interviewed by a reporter from Advertising Age.
Who is Don Draper? Excuse me? Who is Don Draper?
What do men say when you ask that?
Well, they usually take a minute to think about it, and then they do something cute. One creative director said he was a lion tamer.
I don't want to do that. In a third person?
I don't know. Knockout wife, two kids, house in Westchester, take the train. Maybe take your car, now that you can afford it.
Who told you that?
Anything? I mean, now's your chance.
Well, as I said before, I'm from the Midwest. You were taught that it's not polite to talk about yourself.
This is the Don Draper we've come to know and love. Enigmatic, soft-spoken, preferring to let his ad campaigns and their successes speak for themselves. But in this new season, as one of the partners in this new ad agency, that Don Draper won't do. He has to sell himself as well as the products of his clients if his new agency is to make it. And he's not alone. Everyone around him in this period drama is struggling to navigate and survive the 60s. And as they all struggle to do so, they help make it easier for us to survive the summer of 2010.
David Bianculli is TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University in New Jersey. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Okay, one of the great pleasures of being a 21st century movie fan is that so many movies are now available online, and every day more are available. One of the great frustrations is incompatibility. Some formats work on certain devices. Others can be streamed from the internet but not downloaded. Today, a consortium of entertainment and consumer electronic companies announces plans to change that. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports on a new technology called Ultraviolet.
The idea is that online movies should be as easy to get and enjoy as a regular old DVD.
You can buy a DVD from any store and play it on any DVD player.
That's Mitch Singer. He's president of a group that includes movie studios like Paramount, TV manufacturers like Toshiba, and retailers like Best Buy, and about 60 other major businesses that make movies, sell them, or build things that play them. If you want to watch the Swedish movie The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, you can, instantly, on Netflix. But it's a stream. You don't own the movie. You can't burn it or swap it from your TV to your iPod. With Ultraviolet, you can buy a digital movie, watch it across different devices, store it in an online library you can share with your friends, and copy it to DVD.
Once you buy content, you own it.
Singer says you'll still buy movies from regular online retailers. Ultraviolet is just the format, like Beta versus VHS or Blu-ray versus HD DVD. Exact rules and prices have yet to be announced, and it'll just be movies and TV shows for now. Music may come later. And a few big names are holding out. Disney wants to develop its own system, but Mitch Singer says the company is welcome to license Ultraviolet if it ever changes its mind. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
NBC News holds a unique place in broadcast journalism. It's the only old-school network news division that clings to the concept of journalistic impartiality, yet also has a sister cable channel in MSNBC that has found rating success with a primetime ideological tilt, in MSNBC's case, to the political left. The distinctions can get a bit tricky, as NPR's David Folkenflik reports.
Savannah Guthrie is seen as a rising star within NBC News. You can see her on NBC Daily as a White House correspondent.
There's not a lot of good news in this poll for the White House. Gushing oil, persistent unemployment, the real problem.
Or as an anchor of a weekday morning political news and interview show on MSNBC.
The end of an era and potentially a problem for the president's Wall Street reform plans.
Usually, she's paired with her colleague Chuck Todd, though on the day I dropped by MSNBC's Washington Bureau, she was hosting the show solo. As a reporter or host, Guthrie says her mission is clear.
I can tell you what my goal always is to try to think of the one question they'd rather not be asked, just to see what they would say.
Guthrie is a graduate of Georgetown Law who passed the Arizona bar in 2002 with the highest marks of anyone that summer. But she had also worked in local TV news, and after a stint as a lawyer, she joined Court TV covering the trials of Zacharias Moussaoui, Louis Libby, and others. She jumped to NBC, reported on the 2008 presidential campaign, and now her bosses say her promise is unlimited.
I'm constantly blown away by her range.
That's NBC News President Steve Kappas.
She's had a very quick rise within the organization, has absolutely earned respect every step of the way, from nightly news to the Today Show to MSNBC. And those are different clients looking for different things, but she's been able to do it.
In fact, MSNBC can be a very different client. Her show appears at 9 a.m. Eastern, but the primetime hosts who pay most of the bills, such as Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow, all can be found somewhere on the political left. It puts Guthrie's work under extra scrutiny.
I know what everybody says, but to me, we just do straight news, and no one has ever asked me to do anything other than that.
And Guthrie and Kappas both say it'll stay that way. Thanks to Charlie Gibson and Katie Couric, network TV stars no longer have to choose solely between softer news or harder-edged fare. But now, to advance to the big leagues on cable, many anchors find themselves adopting a sharper and often ideological tone, which leads former CNN and ABC News correspondent Charles Bierbauer to offer some advice. Bierbauer is now dean of the Communications School at the University of South Carolina.
This is what I teach students here. Keep your biases to yourself. I don't want to know what they are when I go to the news. If I want opinions, I go to the editorial page or I turn on one of the political food fights. But I know what I'm getting.
Not necessarily so, says former CBS News Senior Vice President Marcy McGinnis. McGinnis is now an associate dean of journalism at Stony Brook University in Long Island. She says the top-rated opinion hosts, the Bill O'Reillys and the Keith Olbermans, blur the lines.
I think the format looks like news. You've got anchors. You've got people talking to reporters in the field. And I think that viewers might be taken in by the fact that it looks so much like a news show that they might not be able to differentiate necessarily the opinion.
Or differentiate the news. Over at the Fox News Channel, where the most dynamic opinion hosts are all somewhere on the political right, anchor Megyn Kelly is another rising star. But her tone can be quite sharp. Recently, she tore into Fox's own Democratic analyst, Kirsten Powers, over an incident involving members of the New Black Panthers at a voting booth on Election Day 2008.
You're putting words in my mouth.
Don't make me cut your mic.
It sounded more like Kelly's tryout to be Bill O'Reilly's understudy than just another day behind the anchor desk. NBC News President Steve Kappas says he's very careful not to push Savannah Guthrie in an ideological direction. He says it would be a waste of her talent. But Kappas is also not apologetic about MSNBC's mix of political news and talk with ideological primetime programming. As he acknowledges, it took a long time for his cable channel to hit on a successful formula. David Folkenflik, NPR News.